Diego in Arizona. There are many tunnels. My friend signed up right before me and paid the $3,000, but then he went missing after he came to the meeting place and paid the money. They found his head a week later in a trash can in Tijuana. Miguel shook his head as he spoke, telling the story as if to admonish us, to teach us a lesson about the dangers of trusting crooked people. He cracked open another beer. I will get back to Nebraska. My sons are there. I just have to be patient. These tomato farmers are crooks and they work us like animals. I can't stay here. I have to be patient. But I have hope. You will see me in the U.S., no question. My son is smart, he said, motioning to the kitchen, where his son had been before. He was slurring now, saying half words and mumbling, and he kept slipping into Spanish. I wondered what would happen to his current wife when he left, if he would bring her with him. He didn't say, and I was too sleepy to ask. Miguel, don't be offended, I said, but I am about to fall asleep from being so tired. Keep talking and hanging out, but I might fall asleep. Oh, of course, I am being rude. Yes, sleep. Weston, do you want to smoke more outside? Yeah, sure, he said. Weston and Miguel walked outside and left me in the dark. It would be Weston and me on this mattress. I huddled to one side and closed my eyes, but instead of drifting off, I fumed. Mad at Weston's bike, mad at his choices and his philosophies. But I also thought of Miguel's kindness, his son, his wife and daughter. I was sleeping in a man's house who saved our butts when we needed it most. I would have passed through this alien tomato farm world without ever really knowing anything about it. But Weston's bike broke. His frustrating choices slowed us down and led us to Miguel. This shitty situation had given us the opportunity to receive the kindness of a stranger, to see the life and home of a person we'd have never known. I lay there thinking back through my life, how much energy I put into planning, trying to guarantee my independence, but how so many of my best memories have come from the times where I needed help and received it. In the morning, we woke to find that Miguel had gone to work at dawn and left us a note scribbled with well wishes. His wife made us eggs, rice, and coffee, and his son informed us he was going to skip school to help Weston fix his bike. Alejandro took us to the closest bike shop, but they only had old mountain bike wheels, nothing that could fit Weston's frame. He needed a new rim, hub, new spokes, the whole wheel. A task we thought would take an hour turned into a day-long quest. We took the bus to a bigger town, where Weston left me at a little restaurant. It had Wi-Fi, so I checked Instagram and FaceTimed my mom. I didn't tell her anything about Miguel's scary stories. I told her we'd stayed with a kind man and his family. I told her all her prejudices about Mexico were wrong. I told her it was safe and perfect. Around 3 p.m., Weston finally returned with a brand new front wheel and tire, though it was 20% smaller than his back wheel. Thank goodness for Alejandro. He saved me. He translated my haggling, Weston said. Alejandro blushed. Weston leaned in. Do you have $20 to give him as a tip? I don't have any more money. When I handed Alejandro $20, he shyly tried to refuse, but I insisted and shoved it in his pocket. Little dude, you're smart, and you speak incredible English, and you're going to make a great life. Thank you, I said. Outside of town, the tomato farms stopped abruptly and left us with cliffs and coastline. Not quite desolate desert, but not as shrub-covered as California's hills. In some of the fields between us and the beach, we saw a red grass of some kind that looked like pools of blood, like we were gazing at the world through a color filter. For the final hour before twilight, we climbed away from the beach, up into steep, treeless hills, and at last light rolled down a long, thrilling grade into a small town nestled in a canyon with a hotel. We got a room and ate Baja lobster for dinner in the attached restaurant. Baja lobster looks similar to the kind found off the coast of Maine, but without large claws, as if the claws have been removed. But the crustaceans themselves can grow to be gigantic. At the restaurant, they had one mounted on the wall, a prize from the past. It was the size of a duffel bag. We ordered two large ones and ate till we were full. We felt we deserved it. We slept hard, woke up, stocked up on snack food and cookies at a tiny market, and headed up the mountains again, away from the ocean. We cycled and baked on hot roads. The mountains leveled off, and we were clocking 50 and 60 mile days. The heat created mirage waves over every dip in the road. Highway 1 crisscrosses Baja all the way down to La Paz, and it is the only main road. I had studied the map obsessively. The incredible thinness of the giant peninsula, the way it looks from a satellite like gold with almost no vegetation visible. The eastern boundary is the elongated crystal blue Sea of Cortez, a breeding ground for manta rays and whale sharks. At the northernmost point of the narrow sea, the Colorado River empties into it, or used to. For millions of years, it spilled water from the Rocky Mountains into the sea, but California, Arizona, and Mexico rerouted nearly all of the river. So now the mouth of the Colorado is a dried-up and apocalyptic marsh. All day and night, semi-trucks roared past us, their loud Jake brakes rattling down the hills like machine guns. Ga-ga-ga-ga-ga-ga-ga-ga-ga-ga-ga. But these truckers are also the caretakers of the road. When we approached a rig that had pulled over for the driver to check his load, he saw us, scrambled into the cab, and emerged smiling with cold water. Somewhere in all those miles of heat and nothingness, I noticed time had changed. Meetings and dates and days of the week used to mean so much to me. They were necessary frames for my life, for the passing of time. Now I never knew what day it was. My alarm was the sun. I woke up when the light was too bright to keep sleeping, or when the desert heat forced me out of my hammock. The work day was movement, making it farther south. Any forward progress felt like work well done. The end of the day came when the sun approached the horizon and golden light signaled the coming darkness. Compensation for my labors simplified too. After climbing a hill, I had earned a cookie or an orange. I would stop at the top, enjoy a snack and some water, and then glide downhill. This was my work. This was my new occupation. I enjoyed feeling like this, but it wasn't pure. It wasn't contemplative. It was survival. It was heat and simplicity. For days, we rode down the barren central spine of the peninsula. My knees were killing me. I ran out of water and drank Coca-Cola. The thought of California made me sad. It was behind me, full of happiness and people I knew. The only thing before me was my front wheel and the godforsaken desert. Where had my optimism gone? Halfway down the peninsula, we did our first 100-mile day. Riding at night was dangerous, but making 100 miles during daylight wasn't realistic. It took us almost all day to cover 60. One morning, the map tempted us with a sizable town, Guerrero Negro, 100 miles away. We talked through the options, then Weston and I decided to go for it, even though we'd certainly have to bike after dark. A hotel and a restaurant and maybe even Wi-Fi were worth risking our lives in the darkness. A relentless sun beat down on us from above, and the road radiated heat up as we cycled down the long straightaways between tan rock mountains on both sides. I drank lots of water. The day passed with almost no talking. We stopped to rest very few times. We found one cafe for lunch inside a woman's house, where we got Coca-Colas in glass bottles and ate tortillas wrapped around rice, beans, and chicken. Then we got back to the road. We pedaled in grim determination. We made it to the coast at dusk, with 20 miles left. More cars and houses appeared along the road. As it got dark, we hugged the narrow shoulder so as not to get hit. Weston's bike had no reflectors and no lights. My bike had both. So I rode in the back, where cars would see me as they sped past. We rode slowly and deliberately. At the crest of a small hill, with sand dunes to either side of us, we saw the lights of town maybe 5 miles away. Guerrero Negro. Mecca. My legs were hurting me so badly, I told Weston I needed a break. We sat on a sand dune and watched the cars ride by while we ate all of the food from our bags, all the snacks, the cookies, and all of it. The pain had kept me from realizing how hungry I was. The inside of my knees felt like grinding metal on metal. My ankles were sore and my tailbone was raw. It was dark, so we didn't feel rushed. It couldn't get darker than black. Finally, Weston took charge. We're almost there, Jed. You can do this. Did you notice we've gone over 100 miles today already? We'll reach 108 by the time we get to town. Weston was being kind, but I got up and hobbled back to the bikes. 15 minutes later, we rolled down the town's main street, lit only sporadically by yellow lights. Bars and a few restaurants were open. Huge whale murals adorned the walls of the two hotels we checked out. We chose the second one because it seemed to be the cleanest, with the most lights on. I was so delirious and in pain that I didn't care what it cost. We rolled our bikes into the little room, and I collapsed onto my rock-hard bed. Weston turned on the TV. We were giddy at having made it, and the prospect of a hot shower and the novelty of sleeping with a roof over our heads. Just seeing humans walking around felt like some deep reward. But 15 minutes into lying there, my stomach started to twist. Then the bloated feeling moved lower. I thought it was diarrhea, so I started to walk to the bathroom. Before I was through the door, my spit got hot and my stomach wrenched like it had been sucker punched. I barely made it to the toilet before I threw up every last bit of food I had eaten. Chunks of salami and cracker and cheese, each heave feeling like it would be my last breath. After my belly emptied, I just kept on throwing up, or trying to. Weston ran out to buy some water bottles. If you're heaving, it's better to throw something up rather than just to dry heave. That's the worst, Weston said. He stayed up most of the night watching over me and lightly scratching my back, mothering me. By the time the sun came up, I was asleep with my cheek on the toilet seat, holding the bowl like my best friend. But when I woke up in the bathroom, I felt better. Better, but weak. Even standing up and walking back to the bed felt like lifting 300 pounds. I was too weak to ride, so we decided to stay another day. The hotel was more expensive than we could really afford, so Weston found some Wi-Fi in the hotel lobby and looked on warm showers. It's an app that lets bike enthusiasts around the world offer couches or floor space and a shower, not necessarily warm, to people on trips like ours. Weston found just one user in town, Erica, and messaged her. She replied almost instantly and said she was excited to host us. An hour later, Erica met us at the bank across the street and led us to her house. The main road's pavement quickly ended, as nearly all the gridded side streets of Guerrero Negro were sand. The sand was too soft to ride over, so we walked our bikes behind her rattled old minivan. Erica was in her 40s and told us in soft, broken English that she worked in the office at the local high school. We were intrigued by her nonchalance at welcoming two strange men into her home. After pushing the bikes through sand for what felt like an hour, we reached her small house to the fanfare of barking mutts. Then 1, 2, 3 teenage sons walked out to greet us. Then her husband. Even though they lived in a desert outpost surrounded by sand flats, the boys dressed like they were from San Diego. Skater brand shirts, flat-brimmed hats, sneakers, two with baggy jeans and two with skinny jeans. As we walked into the house, I asked Erica why she had accepted us for a stay. "I try it my English," she said. "It is very bad. It is good Americans at my house from U.S. I practice my English. My sons, too. You want food?" The house consisted of a living room with an old PC crammed into the corner, a kitchen, and two bedrooms closed off by sheets hung from shower rods. After the niceties of meeting her three sons and husband, I started looking around outside for a place to sleep while Weston carried on with our hosts. There were no trees to hang our hammocks from. I spread out my rain tarp in a shed and lay down for a second, fully aware of how rude I was being, but unable to do anything but sleep. I don't know how long it was, maybe 1 second, maybe an hour, but when I opened my eyes, it was 2 p.m., and the father was standing over me, telling me in Spanish to come inside. It's true what sociologists say. Only about 40% of communication is in the words, and the rest is in the tone, gestures, facial movements. Once inside, he showed me that the couch pulled out into a bed. All I wanted to do was lie down on that bed and sleep until dawn. But with classic Mexican hospitality, the minivan was already running, and he gestured to us to get in. He was taking us on a tour of Guerrero Negro and the miles of salt flats that support the town's main business. My mind was numb and my body was ruined, but when he spoke, I smiled, looking toward whatever he was excitedly pointing at. The salt flats are huge pools of dehydrating seawater, lined with white crystal mounds separating them from each other. Everywhere, heaps of crystallized salt. In my hand, the crystals looked like jewels. He took us from there to town, where we saw a party going on with dancing horses, trotting and doing tricks with master cowboys. We saw a large above-ground cemetery with brightly painted mausoleums. My weakness dominated my thoughts. Weston did a good job of picking up my slack. I could hardly fake delight at all these things. My eyes were half-crossed. When we got back to the house, I crumpled onto the couch. Nearby, the 13-year-old son sat at their PC with a Casio keyboard, watching a piano lesson video on YouTube. He had headphones on, and his playing made no sound. The other two boys sat cross-legged a few inches from the TV watching soccer, but I was hypnotized watching the boy learn piano all by himself. I remembered my own piano lessons as a kid, and how begrudgingly I practiced for 15 minutes a day, with my mother watching me like a hawk to make sure I didn't sneak off to watch TV or eat barbecue potato chips. How inconvenienced I was in my roomy house with so many entertaining distractions. And here was this boy, a lover of music, using the free music lessons posted by some random person in Ohio to learn to play on his busted-up Casio in the middle of a desert town with one paved road. What if he becomes a great musician? I bet he will. I can still see him sitting there, focusing harder on that YouTube video than I've ever been focused on anything in my life. One of life's secrets is tucked away in that moment. I know it is. It has something to do with contrast. I slept well and felt better in the morning. The kids were up and off to school, and after breakfast, we said our sweet goodbyes and reluctantly got back on the road. By now, the charm of being in the wilderness was completely gone. My clothes were stiff with sweat, and my white t-shirts would never be white again. My bike felt heavier than before. Weston's bike seemed more tattered, flimsier. The new wheel squeaked, and I saw it as a warning siren for the next breakdown in the middle of nowhere. Cutting inland from Guerrero Negro, we lost sight of the Pacific for good. While plunging ever southward, we had to cross Baja to reach the coast of the Sea of Cortez. I was constantly nervous about running out of water, rationing, and taking tiny sips. We went full days without seeing a town or hardly a human, all the while steeping in the anxiety of not knowing what lay ahead. Ride. Keep writing. Don't complain. Stay positive. Don't snap at Weston. You're not mean. You're just hungry and tired. I fantasized about a real town with real stores, a place where I could buy fresh t-shirts and underwear. I would stare at the map and see hundreds of miles in all directions with no civilization, and I'd meditate on misery, on my stupid choice to be here. I started plotting a guilt-free escape. What if I claimed I had terrible knee pain and couldn't go on? No one expects me to bike in pain, right? Or maybe I could just do the trip in doses. I'd go home for a month and hit the road for a month. Come back home and write about it, and then hit the road again for another month, all the way down to South America. I could do that, and never be gone long enough to hate myself or the trip. But if I did that, wouldn't people think I'm a pussy, a fraud, not a real adventurer? But the true despair came from my head. California was gone. My home and my friends, the community I had built for a decade, were gone. I wouldn't see any of them for the next year and then some. Maybe a 21-year-old could take this trip and explore the world without worrying about what's happening without him at home. But by 30, I had built a life good enough to miss. To fill the time, I spun fantasies about being back home in L.A. with my friends, with a beer and a good laugh and a TV show marathon. I could marinate on that one image for hours, the way being in love fills your thoughts with the beloved. I was in love with the thought of home. In central Baja, alien-looking trees began showing up on the barren landscape. Trees or cactuses or Dr. Seuss creations, I came to find out they were called boojums. They grow mainly in central Baja and reach up into the sky 15 feet or more. They look like tall, spiny, green road cones and often have no real branches. The kind of plant you could imagine populating Mars. Or like the tails of cute dragons sticking straight in the air, burying their bodies to beat the heat. At night, we lit fires by burning the bones of dead boojums. We hung our hammocks from them. Weston would cook in his single crusty pan while I played episodes of our favorite podcasts, Radiolab, This American Life, Freakonomics, on my portable speaker. One night it got so cold I couldn't sleep. We had found an uncharacteristically lush river meadow in the midst of the dry and barren landscape and made camp there at sunset. The ground was green, covered in tiny white wildflowers. I changed my clothes, hung my hammock, got in my sleeping bag, and fell right asleep. But by 1 a.m., the temperature had dropped from 100 to 45 degrees. The air beneath my hammock chilled my core, and I couldn't get warm again. I just lay there for hours, cursing the world. After unpacking every piece of clothing I had and layering it, I gave up. I thought the ground must hold more heat than the air. I put my Walmart windshield reflector on the grass, stuffed my sleeping bag with my clothes, and finally fell asleep on the ground, either because it truly was warmer or just from total exhaustion. The next morning, I awoke stiff as a fossil, and we packed up. "Wow, that was one of the worst sleeps of my life," I said, going for commiseration. "I slept fine. I was cold, yeah, but I was out." Ugh, damn him. Sometimes it hit me that his man-of-the-earth shtick wasn't a shtick. He really was tough and principled and strong. I think the fact that he wasn't flawless in this gave me ammunition to poke holes, to disregard him. I remembered what his mother said. This happens a lot with people who espouse idealism. We want to feel better about our mediocrity, so we look for holes. That day, we had another forever ride through nothingness, hoping for a tienda where we could buy a cold Coca-Cola, for a place where we could buy lunch, for shade. It was October, and it killed me to think I'd still be on this trip in October a year from now, only so much farther from home. Each time we crested a hill and saw yet another vast valley of emptiness, this feeling hit me with more force. This is what you wanted, I told myself, to be free, out here, living the dream at 30. And for what? To be uncomfortable? Well, you got that. But who cares? What are you really here for? Through all that relentless heat and emptiness, my thoughts were cursing me. Nostalgia for my life in California progressed to the point where all of the imperfections, all of the things that sent me on this trip, my dream of a free life, of self-discovery and adventure, of doing hard things and writing about them, of bucking the system and being wild, evaporated. Home seemed like paradise, so fulfilling and lush. How foolish was I to want to leave it, all to go on some stupid, vacuous, self-absorbed man adventure. I thought about my boyhood in green suburban comfort, about how I got to California in the first place, and eventually had a moment of clarity. I am on this bike, on my spirit quest, in the desert wilderness, I thought. This is where people have revelations. This is where I must learn. Chapter 6. Some background as I lose my mind. Baja and my childhood. As I cycled, Weston ahead of me, I stared at my tires. I worried they were deflating. But as they spun, I couldn't make out if they were getting flatter. My eyes played tricks on me. Too much movement, and you can't see minor changes until it's too late. I had changed in little bits my whole life, never all at once. I thought about growing up, about what got me to California, about my mom, my faith. Weston was far enough ahead of me. Some absurd notion of him overhearing my thoughts was quieted by his distance. My mind left the desert. It reached all the way back, for comfort and understanding. I grew up in Nashville, Tennessee, a place with almost more churches than houses. I realized I was gay at 12 years old. At least, that was when I discovered there was a word for it. In third grade, I guess I was 8, I learned something was off. I was sitting on the school bus one day all the way in the back, and the fifth graders in the next row were laughing and talking about something called a boner. They were huddled 3 in the seat and laughing. Gregarious and friendly as a kid, I leaned into their hushed conversation and spoke up. "What is a boner?" They cackled at my question and, excited, turned to me. "It's when your penis gets bigger." I exclaimed, "Oh my gosh, I get those too." I was so excited to share something with the older kids. They said, "Yeah, so what makes you get them?" "I do from my dad's Sports Illustrated swimsuit magazine," one kid said. "I do from magazines too, Girls in Bikinis," another kid said. I thought I was getting the picture. Yes, I know exactly when they happen. They asked me, "What makes you get a boner?" I blurted out with joy and zero hesitation, "Bodybuilder guys on ESPN. They pulled their heads back like confused birds and furrowed their brows for what felt like a minute, but must have been 2 seconds, and then burst into laughter. "That is so weird," they laughed and laughed. They never called me gay or fag. They didn't call me anything. They just laughed and then turned back to their own conversation. I think I laughed too. I can picture myself, my eyes panicked, my mouth pushing out a laugh. I didn't talk about it again. Nashville in the 90s was a tricky place to be gay. Evangelical Christianity was the dominant culture, although it was so insular and convinced of its rightness that it didn't see itself as a culture. It saw itself as normal, the way things were. I knew my desires were weird, but I didn't know they were gay. I didn't know the word. I'm sure I heard sermons and saw things on television about it, but it went right over my head. It was such a private embarrassment, such a shadow I was afraid to examine, that I truly didn't. I gave my stuffed animals girl names. I cuddled them and thought I was doing the right thing. In church, I would draw spaceships and battles and dragons and monsters on the bulletin. Never looking up, never listening. If I made sound effects as the lasers hit an enemy spacecraft, my mom would shush me, or sometimes lean over and ask, "Why can't you draw something nicer than demons?" I didn't have a good answer. In fourth grade, my friend Ryan slept over. He said, "Have you ever seen people having sex on TV? It's like this." He crawled on top of me, both of us in our pajamas, and wiggled around. Something like butterflies and fireflies and the thrill of the roller coaster drop rushed through me. I loved his weight on me. He laughed as he crawled off. "Can you do that again? That was so funny," I said. He did it again. I may have asked for a third go-around. I discovered my condition had a name when I changed schools in seventh grade. The new school brought new faces and new boys. I noticed their butts in their khakis, and I noticed that I noticed. Then, on some television show, I heard someone talking about being gay, and the whole universe rushed through my mind at once. I thought back on everything I'd heard in church and realized I was the thing they had warned against. I was immoral and bad. This is a wild thing to conclude as a kid. It's not like the moral lessons everyone learns in the course of growing up, like when you call someone a name, see them get hurt, and your conscience teaches you the power of words. Those lessons sting, then move you to better behavior. This revelation was different. I hadn't done something bad. I was something bad. The only you that you know, everything you're becoming, is bad, and there's nothing you can do about it. It's a horrible and complicated headspace to grow up in. This, in my opinion, is why so many gay people turn to art, music, fashion, or comedy. As the world around them grows hostile, their spirit becomes obsessed with the meaning of it all. Straight people, finding the world designed to suit them, don't need to explore its meaning in quite the same way. But gay people don't have that luxury. We must study it, dissect it, reject it, or reshape it. We do this with the thing that was rejected, our heart. When I realized this in seventh grade, I decided that it must be a phase and that I would never speak of it. In that moment, I traded total honest self-expression for observation, for social anthropology. What I mean is, I knew I couldn't be myself, so I had to watch and figure out how to be. On my first day at the new school, a kid picked on me. My voice was too high, and he said that I was a girl. I was so angry at him. His name was Timothy Rogers. You always remember moments like these, the kind that put into words some private fear, and the full name of the person who made you feel that way. I remember standing in the hall, in one of those zoom-out sequences from a John Hughes movie, and seeing an angel on one shoulder and a demon on the other. The demon said, "Just call him out. Yell at him, hate him, be mean, scare him. You're bad now. You're a bad person. Embrace it." But the angel said, "He doesn't know you. You're a nice guy. Make him see that there is no reason to be mean to you, because you're a good person." I know I just said that I felt bad for my feelings, that my desires made me bad, but therein lies the war I fought inside me. I was told that I was bad, but I felt like a good kid. I didn't feel the sin in me, I just recognized that I was supposed to. Existing in this tension became my normal. so it came down to feeling. I am not mean, I said to myself, so being mean will be acting, and acting makes me tired. So I decided to win Timothy over by being friendly. I decided to be a nice person because it felt easier. Between the ages of 13 and 15, I got good at fending off the insults of other people with my sense of humor. I could cut someone off before they'd finished their basic joke about my voice, my limp wrists, or my hands waving in the air. I'd have their friends cackling. I remember a big kid named Jeff Warner stood over me in eighth grade and said, "You're a faggot." In retrospect, I kind of like the way kids insult one another. There is rarely any cleverness, just raw reportage. I think I shot back something existential like, "Well, that came out of nowhere. Yes, I know I talk like a girl, but girls love it. I speak their secret language. All I know is that all the cheerleaders like me, and I'm going to Meredith's birthday party on Saturday. If you were nicer, you would be too." That's probably revisionist history, but I just remember him being surprised by my answer. From then on, I beat them to the punch. I made fun of myself. I mocked my own voice. I exaggerated my silliness to show that I did it on purpose. The deepest hurt was the surprise insult when some kid I didn't know would ask me if I was gay. What? Why did he ask me that? Shoot, what did I do to give it away? No, I just talk like this. I'm over here trying to get attention. I'm weird. I don't want to be like everyone else. I'd felt found out. That was what I had to avoid. So I acted weirder in every way possible. I obsessed over Star Wars and anime and comic books and science. I said weird things that didn't make sense just to throw people off. I raised my hand in Mrs. Shackelford's English class and asked, with the intrigue of a journalist, "Mrs. Shackelford, do you wear a thong?" This, of course, had no relation to anything. It just came to my mind. The class gasped and held in their chuckles and shot their eyes in unison to her. She fought her smile because she liked me. "Jed, you aren't allowed to ask me that," she said. "I'm going to have to give you detention." Leading with my weirdness, I took the ammunition right out of their lips, or gave them words that didn't sting as much. "You're such a nerd, you're such a freak, you're such a weirdo." Those felt nice. Insulation from the other words. And I was friendly, very friendly. I made friends easily, even if they were simply kids who knew my name and liked to see what I would say next. I made it through middle school and kept my sexuality mostly hidden from my friends and from myself, all the while collecting new friends and a reputation. My weirdness got me weird friends. Not quite outcasts, but a solid group of five guys who didn't care to fit in. They didn't take church seriously. They made fun of their stupid parents. They were into Stanley Kubrick films and ranking the best movies of all time. But our wit was sharpened on one another, and primarily on me. My few friends made fun of me constantly. They mocked my sunny disposition. They mocked my voice and my body. Sarcasm was God. There was no time to be kind to one another. We were constantly ranking the best movies of all time and agreed that The Shawshank Redemption was number one. But after that, it was all arguing. Arguing over how terrible the new Spielberg movie was, or how genius it was, or whether or not the score was up to par with older John Williams' work. As high school came, my weirdness faded. I discovered that I could turn the dial on my comedy just a little and make the cool kids laugh. If I was clever instead of weird, if I was smart instead of crazy, I was interesting to them. And slowly but surely, they invited me to things. "Hey, Jed, want to go to the Metallica concert?" "Me? Yes, I love Metallica." I'd never listened to one song by Metallica. They liked the way I made them laugh, but more than that, they didn't mock me. I was used to people laughing at me. These kids were laughing with me. And they were Christians. I gave the Bible a chance in my senior year of high school. I'd been dragged to church my whole life and never given that huge, stupid book an actual chance. I had disregarded Christianity as mythology in a reactionary attempt to find my own identity in the shadow of my mother. But my new best friends were Christians in high school, and I wanted to speak their language. I would like whatever they liked. Everything changed, though, when I read the book of Ecclesiastes. My youth group was dedicating the summer to reading and studying it. Normally, I sat through the teaching with my mind turned off and my pen out, doodling on whatever paper I could find. But the youth leader was reading passages. There is no remembrance of people of old, and even those who are yet to come will not be remembered by those who follow them. For the living know that they will die, but the dead know nothing. They have no further reward, and even their name is forgotten. Meaningless, meaningless, says the teacher. Utterly meaningless. Everything is meaningless. Damn, that is some dark shit. It was dismal, an almost nihilistic sequence of wise sayings and rules to live by. It was from the perspective of an ancient king who received all the luxuries of opulent living and found them empty. Later that week, some of the coolest guys in my grade asked if I wanted to join a Bible study group with them. I said yes, not because I wanted to study the Bible, but because I no longer hated the Bible and I wanted to belong to something. These Christians were nice to me, and these guys were baseball players, football players. Those types of guys hardly ever noticed me, and now they were inviting me to spend time with them, to talk about life and God and this newly interesting book. I relished every meeting, every hang. My weirdness faded into the background. I stopped talking with my hands so much. My voice got deeper. Maybe it was puberty. Maybe it was performance. The Bible study worked on my mind, kneading it in new ways. I believed in these guys and through them started to believe in the Bible. For one, as a teenager, knowing I was gay but not sure what that meant, the feeling of normalcy and acceptance into the dominant culture clique was an incredible relief. Humans want few things more than to belong, and nothing unites people like a common enemy. Faith gave me that. A community of people united against evil, the devil, sin, the secular world, Democrats, sex, drugs, gays. The sense of purpose was incredible. We were on a journey together. That was the crack in my armor, a slight change in perspective, an angle by which belief could sneak in and change my life. There is a reason why organized religion has billions of human beings, the majority of us, under its spell. It is because it benefits us, and if it benefits us, it must have truth in it, some clues to the workings of the universe. If it didn't, it would be unspreadable. And its best trick is to hook you with its beauty and demand you drag with it all the rest. You come for the sound of the choir and go home with the weight of the bricks and the golden cross. It was tiring, though, to know that my very existence was a problem. When you carry a secret for as long as you can remember, years of offhand comments pile up like a CIA case file. One friend would say, "Gay people are so gross," while watching a pride parade on television. Another would say, "Fags, like real fags, are so annoying. Why do they have to talk like that?" I'd file these comments away, and the fear. I'd double-check my voice for difference. Television was my only window into a world where people spoke differently about my secret. In school, in church, in every avenue of my real-world life, I felt alone and burdened by my shameful desires. But the characters on TV were not like anyone I knew. They showed me options that didn't seem to exist in my surroundings. The main show for me was Will and Grace. I saw the character of Will as a gay man who wasn't hypersexual, wasn't the caricature of femininity I had been trained to hate, didn't seem to be overcompensating. This was huge. The model of another way to be what I was. My own curiosity helped, too. I have always been motivated by understanding the workings of things, and the vast majority of sins as talked about by Christianity made sense. Gossip is hurtful and untrue. Greed is unjust and destructive. Promiscuous sex poisons intimacy and emotional strength. But a committed relationship with someone I love? That didn't compute. Weston and I were cycling all day, talking very little. I was excavating my past, thinking over the years and my pain and my fragile masculinity. I came across so confident, so sure-footed. We set up camp each night and ate our salami and cheese, and Weston made lentils over a fire, and we drank boxed wine and Coca-Cola. I didn't talk to him about my cycling thoughts. Not because I didn't trust him, but because I didn't know what to do with it all. I was homesick, but I was also leaning into the lessons I knew I wanted from this bicycle. I was unpacking the bags of my life, spreading the contents on the floor to have a look. Until the summer before I went to college, I kept my sexuality a secret. I never kissed a boy. I never had a secret behind the barn makeout. In the privacy of internet searches and library sneak sessions, I would read all I could about being gay. The causes. Was it a disease? I told my friend Carla first. Early senior year, I overheard her watching a reality show on Bravo and mutter, "I wish I had a gay best friend. It seems like the best thing." I made a mental note. If I can tell anyone, it will be her. She was best friends with all my best friends, too, so I thought she could help me figure out how to minimize the damage. I told Carla on her couch. I cried. "Carla, you know how I've never had a girlfriend?" "Yeah." I don't exactly like girls. Like, in that way." "Oh, really? Do you mean you like boys?" "Yes." I couldn't say the word gay. It stung too much. It felt too covered in blood and fire. "Really?" she said. "I suspected when we were freshmen, but I stopped thinking about it."
"You did?"
"Yeah. You weren't gay or straight. You were just Jed." I felt relieved that Carla was surprised at all. I carried shame at being perceivably gay. Anytime someone asked me, a stranger or a friend, I recoiled in failure that I had not hidden it better. Carla and I planned which friends to tell next. Whit would be next, then Rob, then Kyle. I told them one by one, sobbing, hands over my face, but none of them got up and walked out. None of them called me disgusting or a moral failure. They all said, as if they'd had a secret meeting to get their stories straight, "Jed, I love you, man. This doesn't change anything. Who cares?" It took me hearing that from all of them to believe any one of them. I felt emboldened to move to California for college at USC. The love of my friends, the acceptance, hadn't pushed me away from the faith I knew. It pulled me closer. I wasn't rejected by the church for being the way I was. I was loved. My community loved me. I wasn't the stereotype my church had been taught to fear and reject. I was their friend first, and they couldn't kick out their friend. I loved Jesus for not taking my friends from me. The least I could do for him was keep my lips and hands and penis to myself. The deeper I got lost in my past, the farther I rode behind Weston. I wasn't watching the road. I was looking through glazed eyes. When I would stand to pump the pedals up a hill, the bike wobbled hard back and forth. I went through my 20s in California. My love of God, tall 100-year-old cacti rolled by. I sat up straight and leaned back and felt the wind on my face with a good downhill coast. Sweat poured from my helmet. I was cooking in the sun, but my thoughts remained in Los Angeles. My mind was ticking through the last decade, what had come of it, what it meant. The wager I had made with God as I drove out to California from Nashville in 2001. "I will stay celibate. I won't throw my body around without your blessing. I feel like it is okay to be gay, but I know that's not what your word says, so I'll let you make the call. If you bring a boy into my life that loves God, loves the Bible, and loves me, I'll know it's from you. If you don't, I won't risk being wrong just to feel good. This I promise you. I became a leader in my college youth group. I went to Christian retreats and camping trips. I had a great time. And God never sent me a godly man, or a woman, or anyone, just lots of friends. By the time I turned 27, the same telescoping of time and the future that sent me on this trip shone its light on my romantic retardation. I am almost 30, and I've never touched anyone. Is this my life? Back in California, I knew of a guy at my church who was happily married to a woman. He had a daughter. I had been open with some of the leaders about my sexuality, about my struggle, and they told me about Derek and his triumph over the deception of homosexuality. He had overcome his struggle and been freed. I asked if he knew of any meetings. He told me about an organization called Exodus International and said he'd be glad to take me to their weekly meeting. 2 weeks later, I met him at his house to go. I was so tired of the theological acrobatics, so ready to be done with it. I wanted a wife. I wanted a kid like he had. I wanted his nice house in Long Beach with an Audi in the driveway and no good Christians breathing down his neck to change. I didn't know him well, but I had made up his healed life as a dream. His wife and daughter were home. His house was beautifully decorated. He was sweet and spoke to me about freedom and loving his wife. He said he had been with boys before his wife and never figured out how to shake the shame. He said being with his wife made him feel whole and accepted in the sight of God. He spoke quietly and with great calm. He showed me some photos of him in his 20s when he was active in the gay lifestyle. His eyes were alive. His smile was ear to ear. Maybe it's because he was younger then. He drove me to the meeting and hardly said a word. He put on worship music. The image of an uncle driving his niece to get an abortion came into my mind. A heaviness, a necessity. The meeting was held in a church on Venice Boulevard in Mar Vista. I sat with my friend near the back. This was a free meeting. There were weekend seminars you could pay for that were more in-depth. Tonight was just an intro. When we showed up, there was a guy on stage singing and playing a guitar. He was in his 50s, thick and muscular, with a buzzed head, and had the look of a motorcycle gang member. He had a high voice, and his S's held. He wore the guitar on his hip softly and sang, "How great is our God," over and over. I surveyed the crowd, probably 60 people, mostly older than me, in their late 30s, 40s, and 50s. Mostly men, but some women. Most were singing. A few stayed seated, looking at their hands or the back of the pew before them. When the singing ended, a small, bald white man came to the stage. He had electric eyes, as if animated only by caffeine or speed, but aggressively so. Around his eyes were tired wrinkles. His face was red and flushed. "Welcome, everyone. For those of you here for the first time, you are especially welcome. For those returning, welcome back to a place where you can feel safe, loved, and accepted in the arms of Jesus." He spoke with conviction, but an odd one, an urgency, almost a controlled anger, reciting kind words. He spoke about the freedom of Christ, the lies our desires tell us, how the heart is deceitful above all things, Jeremiah 17:9. He said our culture is lying to us, that the shame we feel is God calling us home. I surveyed the room and felt such a heaviness. I noticed the man next to me, mid-40s, handsome, a little too tan and clothes well chosen and fitted. He listened to the sermon squinting, almost wincing. He worked his lips, thinking. It looked like he was arguing with someone unseen. "Now I want everyone struggling with homosexuality to stand up. You're safe here. Stand up. We're going to have Kyle come back up and play some music. And here's what I want you to do. Forgive whoever touched you, whoever abused you, whoever molested you. Was your mother overbearing? Did your father abandon you? Who did this to you? Were you molested? Raped? Don't let them have power over you. Give it to God. He wants to take it from you. Put it on Jesus. He is the man you're meant to love. Men, he will free you to love women. And women, he will free you to love men. So now, say the name of whoever did this to you. Shout it out. Set them free and set yourself free. The music began playing and names flew. People were shouting. The first one came awkwardly, like an out-of-tune trumpet.
Michael Green, I forgive you. Michael, Michael, Jesus forgives you.
Then the others came all at once. One man said,
Ryan, 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 Ryan.
Another said, Mother, Mother, Mother. Another said, Uncle Daryl, Uncle Daryl. I stood in silence and looked around the room. People held their hands high and shouted. The music was loud. I had never been molested. I have great parents. Sure, they got divorced. Maybe that made me gay? Did my dad abandon me? No. Did he neglect me? Not to my knowledge. Maybe I've blocked something. Maybe I was molested. Was I? Am I traumatized and I've blocked it out? No. I had no one to forgive. No one made me this way. Nothing I can trace made me this way. I just like boys. As the man on stage continued the forgiveness session, a Bible verse came into my head. John 10:10. The thief comes only to steal and kill and destroy. I came that they may have life and have it abundantly. I looked around the room. Where was the life and life abundant? These people were zombies. Another verse came to me, Matthew 7:15. Beware of false prophets, who come to you in sheep's clothing, but inwardly they are ravenous wolves. You will know them by their fruits. Do men gather grapes from thorn bushes or figs from thistles? Even so, every good tree bears good fruit, but a bad tree bears bad fruit. This was good fruit? This was life abundant? I looked at my friend sitting next to me. His face was tired. He seemed like a broken horse, saddled and roped to a fence. He drove me back to my car. I told him thank you, and I felt worse, like the healing was a scam. I met a guy a few days later and kissed him. I was 28 and let him lead. And in the 2 years leading up to my trip, I kissed a few other boys and dated my first boyfriend. We had sex. I said, I don't know what I'm doing. He said he would show me. He was tender and kind. I went on this bike trip to chase adventure and avoid the assembly line life of routine and expectations, right? That is why I ran off from my 20s to South America. But unpacking my childhood, my faith, my sexuality, walking through the building blocks of my mind, I could see I had a lot of things pulling strings in the shadows, making decisions for me just outside my view. I was 30 years old, a rugged adventurer and a sexual infant. I just kept pedaling, talking to God, not Weston. And by that I mean thinking, staring at the ground, at the mountains, feeling my smallness in the bigness of the world, feeling how ancient and powerful the desert was, how disinterested it all was in my life and in whether I touched my lips to someone else's, how entire mountain ranges could disappear and I wouldn't care, but if I kissed someone or didn't, I would be elated or devastated. I made a lot of miles boiling in thoughts like this. We made it down the rest of Baja without much incident. In spite of the gruesome tales about Mexico and drug cartels and beheadings, we only met kindness. The police at the many checkpoints laughed as we approached on bikes and offered us water and advice on our route. Truckers continued to pull over to hand us more water. Even the tarantulas and scorpions moved over as we passed, as if saying, "Off to you, good sir." I rode many miles with only my mind as the enemy, missing home, missing my friends.